All right. I have the pleasure of calling this August discussion to order. My name is Phil Weiser. I'm the Executive Director of the Silicon Flatiron Center. I know many of you, not all of you, we're excited to have these discussions. Evan Rothstein is right over here. Let me start with Evan because we are being hosted today by Brownstein, Hyatt, Barber, and Streck. It's a long CU success story, this firm, and the Evan Rothstein story is a fun one because it involves Evan reaching out to me when I was a fairly recent faculty member saying, I'm really interested in technology law. I'm choosing between Georgetown and CU. Where should I go? And I put him in touch with someone who I think may not be the mix today, David Huberman, a longtime friend of the program, now general counsel of Code 42. And David went to Georgetown and said, I've been here in Colorado around CU. And if you want the technology, this is the place to come. So Evan came. He was the editor of our technology law journal. He took a number of classes with me and other people in the IT area, and now he's a partner here at Brownstein hosting us. Thank you for your generosity, Evan. Appreciate it. We're going to have people on the panels today that will also be from different generations of CU, Silicon Flatiron, many long-time involved folks. So this has been a topic, patent law, that we've been involved in a long time. And the technological changes that have challenged the patent system have given rise to lots of interesting issues. A series of Supreme Court decisions, starting, depending how you count, with the eBay case 2006. Some early, call it thought leadership from the FTC and the National Academy study, discussions in Congress that ultimately culminated in the American Vents Act, where I had the pleasure of working with a party as we sort of fought for the administration, is this what we, you know, see as the right future. And now we're watching this all play out, and lots of people who are actually on the ground live in consternation, fear, uncertainty, and often frustration about where this is all going. And so that's what we're going to talk about, where is this all going. And we're going to talk about it in a new format. So Silicon Flatiron believes in innovation and experimentation, and so we're going to have breakout sessions, and there are three options. I'll introduce them now. One is the Section 101 limitations on patentable subject matter, which is obviously a big issue. Second, functional claiming in software. And third, the Patent Trademark Appeals Board, which is one of the recent innovations and how it's playing out. And four, how artificial intelligence can automate and manage our patent system. I want to say on the fourth one, we appreciate Mike Drapkin's willingness to embrace it as a moderator. We went through several possible moderators who all said, I'm sorry, I'm really uncomfortable with this topic. So if you're into this topic, I might suggest you go to that session. Wanted to get to hear from all sessions at the end. For those who don't believe artificial intelligence is coming, it may not be here immediately, but it's coming. Please come to a future Silicon Flatiron conference. So look at the ones we have for the spring. We have our Digital Broadband Migration Conference, which is going to be the waterfront of information policy with lots of heavy hitters around the information policy landscape. That's February 12th and 13th. We have March 9th, I believe, is the Artificial Intelligence Conference. And just to plug Harry Sertin, the work that Harry has done on artificial intelligence and automation is as good as any legal scholar in the U.S. And so we're so lucky to have you here, Harry, and that conference will reflect a lot of Harry's vision and thinking. It's a big deal. And for our society, it's a big deal. We're also having a content conference. Cristelia Garcia can't be here today, but she is an unbelievable find for us at CU Law. She teaches in the copyright area, and her background includes having worked at law firms, at MySpace, and for a music studio. She puts a lot of these issues through the lens of the artist, and we're going to talk about the standard for copyright infringement, which has been raised by the Blurred Lines case. For those who are following this, it is a very big deal for the music industry and probably for other industries as well. The date of that is, Anna, March, what's the date of the content conference? It's not on the back. It's on our website. Anna, can you hear me in the back? This is a bad sign. Anna, you can't hear me?
Yeah, we're trying to get someone to turn it off, but it is hard to hear you.
All right, so I'm going to talk louder. I'm going to delay this for a little bit longer so we can fix our microphone issues. Anna, what date is the content conference?
March 23rd.
March 23rd. That was my guess. So please consider coming to other events. We're going to try to do more events in Denver. And thank you, Dave St. John Martin, will be hosting one of them with Juliet Tyam. For those who follow cybersecurity issues, since the recent hacking of the DNC. Juliet has been on CNN and other outlets regularly talking about it, former official with Homeland Security. Dave, what's the date for that event?
So
am I. You can look at our website. We're having a lunchtime event. Again, second experiment, trying to do more events in Denver, make it easier for people. We really welcome your feedback. So if you can talk to any of the moderators today, talk to myself, Anna Noskazi, any thoughts you have about the substance or format of today's conference or anything we do, we really need to hear from you. One of our core commitments is to stay fresh and relevant in how we do what we do. The leaders of each breakout session are listed, as well as where people go, and we'll have a short break to facilitate that. We'll then come back, have a wrap-up panel, and then finally a reception. Okay, so I'm trying to think of what student is in the back. I think Hewitt, you're in the back row, right?
Yes.
Can you hear me now, Hewitt? Am I coming through?
I can.
All right, so Hewitt, your job, among other people's jobs, also Dan, if somehow you can't hear, will you raise your hand so we can make sure to fix that? We have a tremendous panel to start things off. I am so delighted that we have such great perspectives, people who've been around this for a long time. I'm going to start with Artie, who I mentioned, who worked at the PTO, who also is a professor at Duke University and really one of the nation's foremost authorities on the PAT system innovation and its impact overall. We're thrilled to have you here. Suzanne Michel actually was one of, if not the most significant authors of the FTC report. Is that a, can I say that? Is that fair?
The 2011 report.
Okay.
There was a help around the 2003.
She can't claim that much credit on 2003, but there was a follow-up report where she can claim that. She's now at Google and has followed these issues closely for quite some time. For those who haven't followed Qualcomm's role in the patent discussion, they've been very engaged. Roger Martin is their guru and point person. We've had lots of folks from Qualcomm over here. It's awesome that you join us. We've had both Jacobs join us at different times. It really is an unbelievable success story and has a significant presence here in Colorado as well. The wireless issues there touch on other sides of Silicon Valley too. So, Roger, great to have you here. And then finally, John Duffy, who has been a longtime friend and participated in different events. He, you know, like Hardy, is really at the top of the Legal Academy's discourse. He also has some very impactful work in practice. And for those who think legal scholars are irrelevant, John can claim responsibility for invalidating or calling into question a series of judges, right?
Oh, the patent judges,
yeah. That's a pretty big deal. I mean, for legal scholars who generally wonder whether their work ever makes an impact, I have to say that work was highly impactful, and that's the work that John has done. He's really a very careful scholar, and we're so fortunate to have him. So I want to get going with what will be an interactive discussion. The goal here is teeing up the issues that will broadly get discussed. We'll go deeper then in the breakout groups, and we'll come back and try to bring it all together, and then we'll talk about it afterwards at the reception. So I want to start with patent litigation. It's worth noting that the American Vents Act did not take on as such and as directly what many call the patent litigation mess. And there's different ways you can explain why you think it's a mess. One way is, why in the world is so much litigation happening in the Eastern District of Texas? For people who are outsiders and look at that, they really shake their heads. And there's been recent reports, including an FTC report that Suzanne was not involved with, that looked at the role of, pick your words, but I'll call them patent assertion entities, that many of them were, I think the FTC said this pretty much, misusing the process. And so I just want to start with Eastern District of Texas. What do you think about the criticisms of it? What do you think about the legislative reforms? And what do you think about the current Supreme Court case addressing it? And then secondly, has the development of the PTAB ameliorated what some saw as a problem? Has it created a new problem? So, Artie, I'm going to let you take that one on first.
All right. Folks can hear me in the back. I don't know who the student is who should be raising their hand. Yes? Okay, great. So I'm going to move the microphone, though, a little bit. Okay, so I will not say a huge amount about the Supreme Court case, T.C. Heartland, because one of the lawyers on that case is on this panel, John Duffy, and I am merely an amicus supporter of his efforts in that case. That case is a case that challenges the Federal Circuit's view that venue is basically available anywhere there's personal jurisdiction. And I agree with John that I think that view is mistaken given Supreme Court precedent on the question. I also think as a policy matter, it's been an unfortunate development to see the Eastern District of Texas be the home of so much patent litigation. I think that there are judges there who probably are not always acting in the most neutral fashion to Mali, and there have been, as some of you probably know, a slew of law review articles. I didn't author any of them, but a slew of law review articles making pretty dramatic assertions about things that are going on there, and we will see how the Supreme Court deals with all that in the T.C. Heartland case, and John will talk more about the details of that, as will others on the panel, I'm sure. Let me talk a bit about the PTAB, because that's where my current research is focused, and some of you may not have the opportunity to attend our breakout session on the PTAB. Without stealing the thunder of that breakout session, which I think will be wonderful, I think it's fair to say, and again, I'm a little bit prejudiced because I was involved in the American Invents Act push, if you will, that helped to set up the PTAB. I think the PTAB has been useful, and it has problems as well, and we will talk about those problems when we do the breakout session in greater detail. But I think on balance, the fact that one can get a relatively inexpensive determination of validity from an expert community of judges is a good thing. I do think that the PTAB judges have shown themselves to be neutral in the main and expert in the main. What they have been less good about, perhaps, is dealing with some of the procedural snafus that emerge with any new body. So, for example, I think there is an issue with respect to serial petitioning at the PTAB, perhaps constituting a little bit of harassment of patent owners on occasion. I think those are relatively small points, and the PTAB, from what I understand, in terms of reducing the nuisance value of some of these suits that are brought by patent assertion entities, it has brought down the nuisance value to the extent that the PTAB petition, taking it all the way through, costs $100,000 to $200,000. That reduces the nuisance value of settlement accordingly, and that, I think, is a good thing. So with that, I will...
Well, having given a shout-out to John, I think we should go next to him and let him talk a little about the Heartland, the case, and also his thoughts more broadly.
Sure. Let me throw a microphone here. So just before Christmas, the Supreme Court granted cert in a case where I'm acting as a lawyer. That might sound scary to you because I'm a full-time academic and yet sometimes I act as a lawyer. It might sound a little scary, but nonetheless, I occasionally do it. The issue in the case is whether the Federal Circuit's decision, the Federal Circuit's interpretation of the patent, special patent venue statute, is consistent with the Supreme Court precedent. And I think many people didn't realize that the entire phenomenon of the Eastern District of Texas and the sort of concentration of patent litigation in just a few districts in this country, with the Eastern District of Texas being accounting for, we have statistics on this, as of last year, about 44% of all litigation was filed in that one district. All of that traces back to the Federal Circuit's rejection of Supreme Court precedent from a 1957 precedent called Four Coat Glass. And the petition for certiorari is a very simple petition because it ends with a question presented that is literally cribbed from Supreme Court decision. So the question presented is whether 28 U.S.C. section 1400B is the sole and exclusive provision governing venue and patent infringement action and is not to be supplemented by 28 U.S.C. 1391C. Now, you might think, gee, that sounds like a really boring way to phrase a question. Why did you, you know, usually I like phrasing a question so that when you read the question presented, you know exactly what it means. And the reason it was written that way is that except for the word whether, it's a direct quote from Supreme Court precedent, because that's what they said. They said that that section numbers haven't changed since 1957. They said this one section is the sole and exclusive provision, and it's not to be supplemented by this other section. The Federal Circuit said the exact opposite. And so the cert petition, which is where there's been no briefs filed since then because we're still in the first stage of the briefing cycle, the cert petition basically said, Supreme Court, you held this. Federal Circuit held the contrary. And we'd like you to decide whether your precedent is still precedent or the Federal Circuit is precedent. And in the cert petition, we did talk a lot about the public policy, about why this question is important, because that's one of the factors under Supreme Court rules that you're supposed to talk about. And to me, it seemed like hitting a nail with a bazooka, because we had articles from the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post. We had law review articles talking about how this was really a scandal. There was even a segment on John Oliver, believe it or not, that talked about the Eastern District of Texas.
Did you cite John Oliver?
We did not. I think Armiki did. Armiki did. We decided we're going to draw the line. We were willing to cite the New York Times, even though there's some question these days about whether it's fake news or not. But we cited the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, and USC Law Review and some other law reviews. We drew the line at John Oliver. We didn't cite John Oliver, but Armiki, respectable, filed by a respectable law firm, did cite John Oliver. And it's kind of, as usual, it's kind of a funny skit.
Are there any arguments by law professors on the other side?
Well, not yet. But so at the cert stage, you're an idiot if you file on the other side. Because at the cert stage, you're all trying to say, the respondent's saying, there's nothing here to see, this is not interesting, nothing new, go away, don't pay any attention to this case. If you file a brief on that side and say, this is really an unimportant case, it's so unimportant that we went through the tens of hours of time writing a brief and paid a printer to print up a nice little brief, all because we want to tell you this is really unimportant, that's just counterproductive. So we had all our amici on our side. I think we had 56 some law professors, 54 law professors. We had a bunch of industry groups, trade associations, some private companies. So there was a fair bit of support on our side. But that the support, the amici support at cert stage is always one-sided. We don't know. Obviously, we're not privy to who the respondents amici are likely to be. They don't have to tell us. We will probably file, as is true in many of these cases, that both sides usually agree on a letter that they have to get consent from you, or they have to inform you under Supreme Court rules. But on cases like this, it's just normal professional courtesy to file a letter that each side gives consent to everybody. Everybody's amici. So we don't know. There probably will be some professors against us, I think, maybe.
Not me. I was one of the lead people on pro you.
Yeah, I know.
But I know I've been told by my fellow professors that you're wrong.
Shock here. It's debatable opposition.
So yeah. So there is. I've made it sound one-sided. And if I made it sound one-sided, well, that's my lawyer hat going on. And I would take that lawyer hat off and give you a more neutral academic view and present fairly the other-sided hat, except that I can't do that because I'm a lawyer in this case. So I have to present only one side of the case. I do think we're right, though. I think nothing's ever certain in the law, but let's put it this way. I don't think the Supreme Court grants cert to affirm in a case like this.
So two quick questions, and I'm going to segue to a third one for Roger. So first question is, if the Supreme Court rules your way, that simply says there's a different statute, Federal Circuit apply the right statute, and the Federal Circuit come up with a standard as to whether or not venue is appropriate or not in particular cases.
Well, not really, because the other statute is relatively clear. about where you can sue.
So what would be your prediction? If you win under that statute, what percent of cases are in each district? That goes from 44 to what?
So actually, there's some good academic articles that have now recently tried to predict that number, and,
yeah.
and some say that it's a reduction in, you know, down to that the Eastern District of Texas would lose about half or more of its business,
right.
and that's assuming that no one moves there. There's a couple facilities that firms have who are defendants there, and they could move them, like, you know, 10 miles to the west, and then they wouldn't have a regular and established place of business. But the statute says you either have to be incorporated in that state, which isn't going to be true for a lot of the defendants, or you have a regular and established place of business plus commit acts of infringement. So some of the companies, not our company, but some of the companies have businesses, have locations there, and it might be a question whether they commit acts of infringement there. They could some of them could maybe relatively easily move their places of business to a different spot in Texas, and they'd be out of the Eastern District of Texas.
Second question, any thoughts on the PTAB?
The PTAB is kind of interesting. I think one of the hard things, I think that the PTAB would not exist if the Federal Circuit had done its job properly. That's a rather bold thing to say, but I think that the Federal Circuit for decades pushed validity issues to the very end of litigation and pushed validity issues to the jury. And both of those things are hugely controversial. It's pretty clear that they're wrong based on recent Supreme Court precedent, that your validity issues are issues of law and therefore can be decided by a judge, just like claim construction in a Markman hearing. And that should have been done a long time ago. And if those had been done, I think you wouldn't have the PTAB. And I think the PTAB itself is actually an attempt to try to go back to the way things were before the jury became involved in patent validity, because it used to be that most patent cases were brought as equity suits, and there'd be a special master in equity who would decide validity rather quickly and also decide infringement issues. And frankly, I think that way of deciding patent cases, which doesn't have the weird bifurcation of issues that you have at the PTAB, might be a superior way to actually get to a rather rapid decision about patent validity.
You want to respond to that?
Yeah, just on the PTAB piece, and one point on T.T. Heartland, but I'm sure that Roger will have more to say about T.T. Heartland in particular. The point on the PTAB is, there I disagree with John. I think that having district court judges decide validity certainly would be an improvement over juries, but I don't know that your typical district court judge is particularly well placed to decide validity either. And in fact, if T.T. Heartland goes the way it does, I suspect it will, rather, we'll have even more dispersed patent litigation, and these judges will not necessarily be particularly well equipped to decide patent cases, the judges that hear the cases. On T.T. Heartland, the one point that is worth noting, and I do know that they're probably going to be maybe making this point, is that for biopharmaceutical firms, this is going to be a real issue with respect to where they get to sue generics in so-called declaratory judgment actions or in so-called Hatch-Waxman actions under paragraph 4, because they've always been able to sue in Delaware, which is where they like to sue. And those are very experienced judges. After what I discussed, will be decisions in Harlan. As a policy matter, they may have to go lots of different places, that may not be the greatest thing as a policy matter.
So, Arnie, let me do the follow-up to that question, and I'll get Roger involved. If Congress did it exactly opposite, which is what Diane Wood argues, you should have specialized district court judges and general appeals courts.
So I've written about 5 articles along those lines, so I'm prejudiced. Yeah, I think that where we needed expertise was at the district court level, and at the appellate court level, what we needed was a broader range of views and certainly a broader range of experience with respect to business law.
So, Roger, here's my question for you, teeing up all of that, which is the dynamic of the Federal Circuit and the Supreme Court is a fascinating study, and over the last 20 years, going back to Markman, and then I'm going to forget the case that the next case where the Supreme Court started overruling the Federal Circuit. The Federal Circuit is rivaling the Ninth Circuit in levels of if the case gets taken, they're going to be reversed. I don't know what the exact track record is in Federal Circuit 20 years compared to the Ninth Circuit, but those two certify the lowest affirmed rate of any circuit. So first start off with, if you can help people, because neither of you have in the weeds of TC, you know, what's going on with that dynamic, and then how does that get the TC Heartland apply? Do you share the view that the case is likely headed towards a real change in Denver?
So from my perspective, my role at Qualcomm is my role at Qualcomm is I lead the strategy, prep and cross, work on litigation and licensing support. So I'm on the kind of a hybrid between the legal and business side. So I can only speak from that place. And I would really embarrass myself if I tried to talk smart about the case law and you know the dynamics of how the Federal Circuit interacts with the Supreme Court. There's so much more expertise on this panel than me. However, from my perspective on just talking first of all about venue, Qualcomm has had to defend numerous times in Texas, and he is inconvenient, right? But in a lot of ways, I think that the feedback mechanism for whether or not a particular venue is doing a good job is that the appellate and then the Supreme Court and from my perspective, the idea of fixing something associated with venue is trying to come in from the side and address a symptom of either judges in the Ninth Circuit or judges at the Federal Circuit or judges in Texas not having either the right expertise or having an axe to grind or being improperly motivated. So while that doesn't directly answer your question, my point of view on such things as venue is that even taking a broader perspective, I'd much rather be litigating in Eastern District of Texas, for example, than in a lot of the countries that we're now litigating.
So do you like Artie's proposal then? You should have specialized district court judges ready for patents and litigation cases?
Look, I actually think that the more the judge knows about the patent law, the better the result is going to be. Okay. And now from a broader innovation policy perspective, I haven't thought through in any length, how that will affect companies that are differently situated than mine, right? How that will affect smaller inventors versus, a large company like Qualcomm with a lot of patents. You mentioned PTAB. There's not a lot of people out there throwing tons of Qualcomm patents into PTAB.
No.
You wouldn't?
No.
No, okay. But it's funny, it's not even on my radar. This patent is not really even on my radar.
Wow.
Now, it might be next week that, karma sneaks up on
me. Yeah, knock on
wood. You arrogant, so now, anyway, and Eastern District of Texas, even though we've had to defend there a handful of times, again, it's for me not as big as some of the broader issues associated with, and I don't mean to pan the question at all. I just mean that, those issues for Qualcomm as a company, those aren't the ones that are taking up my time.
It's a great reality check. All right, Suzanne, why does Qualcomm not think about PTAB? You said you had the answer to that.
I think PTAB has been an absolutely fantastic development for the patent system and innovation at large in the way the patent system works for innovation. And the reason is because you've got, as Artie said, these really highly skilled people making difficult decisions on patent validity and making those decisions early in litigation. I know lots and lots of people who have been hired onto the PTAB. I have to say I've been uniformly impressed and sometimes wildly impressed about the kind of hiring they've been able to do. They're really good. We've been very impressed by the quality of the decisions even when we lose, and we have lots. But they're thoughtful, The PTAB judges show up to the hearing very well prepared, really digging in deep. You can't wave your hands at the PTAB and the patent. The reason I say, like, I'm not that surprised Qualcomm hasn't been challenged at the PTAB is that there are some important safety mechanisms built into the IPR, the inter partes review procedures. When the AIA was being debated in Congress and about creating this kind of procedure, there was a lot of deep thinking about preventing harassment of patentees. That was a big concern, that you wouldn't want just patents thrown before the PTAB just to, like, make the patentee spend money, right? And so some of those safety valves that are in there, it's a high level to get in. Reality is more likely than not. There's an estoppel provision that the petitioner is stopped from raising any issues they could have raised in later litigation. And it's a very front-loaded procedure. Artie said 100 to 200,000. I want to find out who those lawyers are. We're spending a lot more money on that on every upfront
decision. All right, there's some more room here.
It's a pretty expensive process if you're a big company in high-stakes litigation. I'll say that a lot less expensive than district court litigation, and that's a good thing. But it was designed so that the petition challenging validity had to be very front-loaded. You're supposed to put your best arguments as a petitioner challenging validity into that petition up front. What that means is we don't put every patent that we're sued on into IPR. We're actually pretty thoughtful about it, because if you lose that IPR as a defendant in litigation, you've now gold-plated that patent forever, and you're going to have to settle that case and for a lot of money. So, and you're going to be stopped in making arguments in district court and things like that. So we put in patents where we feel pretty confident of winning.
Complimented Qualcomm.
I think what you just said
is that if you're a company who's serious about the quality of your patents, it's not an accident that you don't end up in the PTAB. Is that a fair
statement? I think that's helpful. I think it's helpful if you have high quality patents and you're a company that's in licensing negotiations, you're not bringing nuisance value cases. And this would tie into your opening about the sort of litigation mess and what the FTC talked about in this recent report. What the FTC did that was really interesting was they provided data to show that actually a lot of the patent assertion entity / troll litigation really is nuisance value litigation. And a lot of us in the tech industry who have a lot of that type of litigation have been saying this for a long time and saying we need to have some serious discussions about what that means for innovation and how to fine-tune our litigation and patent system. But you couldn't prove it, because your settlements were always under non-disclosure agreement. It was just a very hard thing to prove. It's like, take our word for it. Is it we're in settlement negotiations where the plaintiff is saying, look, it's going to cost you $5 million to litigate. Why don't you pay us $1 million? Or, you know, and the price varies depending on who's doing the talking, right? And so the FTC put forward that data because they were able to issue subpoenas that they as an agency have this ability to do what they call a 6B study to send out general subpoenas, give us your general and give us information and get in information that is otherwise confidential that no one else is ever going to be able to get access to. You know, they can't, they keep it anonymous and all of that. But they were able to talk about, yeah, there is nuisance value litigation going on, and that's the kind of the patents and those kinds of litigations are really the kind that you want to be able to have an expert body to make an early determination on validity for, and that is also the good of innovation.
And you wanted to mention T.C. Garland, and then you said also. Suzanne, any thoughts on that?
Well, like Roger, I will say Google has had positive experiences in the Eastern District of Texas, too. We've won 3 very major trials there before a jury, including invalidating patents. It's a very difficult and scary high-risk thing to do. because validity on a technical patent before a jury can feel like a coin toss, whereas before the PTAB, you know when you have good arguments and you know that you can. So it's not to say that anything unfair is happening there. Brian Love, an academic at Santa Clara, released a paper in the past week of studying Eastern District of Texas litigation. And, you know, what he reported on that is consistent, I think, with most companies' experience is that it's a very expensive place to litigate. And the reason it's so expensive is that they have a relatively broad early upfront discovery. The mindset there, which I'm not saying saying that bad, but the mindset is there. It's the judge's job to get this case to a jury. We have a jury system in this country, and as much as possible ought to go to the jury as fast as possible. You know, considering whether that's the best case for innovation, and given how complex the patent system is, but that is the mindset there. And I think, you know, that is one reason it's an attractive place for plaintiffs. And why we see so much nuisance value litigation filed there, because it's a place where you're less likely to get a decision on the pleadings or a summary judgment decision, less likely to get the case stayed because of an IPR going on. And so, you know, if your goal as a plaintiff is to extract nuisance value, you want to know where it's expensive.
Great. So I want to preface the next question with a shout-out. So I think I saw John here along with Mike and Tom, who spent a lot of time helping Denver get a regional patent office. And your work was extraordinary. And Molly is here somewhere, or will be, who's the head of the Denver patent office. It's a great thing for the community to have a patent office. And the spirit behind it is with regional distribution for patent offices, you can get new talent in and help the system function better. And that was the argument that the administration accepted. Artie was a fan of that as well. And I believe we here in Colorado can show that very true. This segues to a question about the quality of patents and whether we should be worried to the extent that low-quality patents get issued. Everyone here who is remotely in the know has seen the peanut butter and jelly sandwich without the crust, or the swing, or any number of patents that people say, gosh, how does this patent ever issue? And Mark Lemley said years ago, in what he called rational ignorance of patent office, is, hey, since most patents don't become consequential, it's good to have a very, let's say, modest front-end process that allows for maybe over-inclusive on approval, with the PTAB helping gold plate patents or them getting tested litigation. That theory has gotten some challenging as of late, people saying that, you know, you've got more nuisance suits based on bad patents. And the future, as I mentioned with artificial intelligence, might make it easy and cheaper to assess the quality of patents with less time and effort. And that's a big question around patent quality and where it's going. Roger, I'll let you start off first, because you got this high compliment. You guys managed to have very high quality patents. Do you worry that the system itself doesn't generate the quality patents that you guys tend to focus on, that it may have a lot of, whatever you want to call them, questionable patents out there that do like litigation, or do you maybe see Mark Lemley's theory as a good justification for instance?
In general, I can tell you that our practice at Qualcomm is to focus very, very much on the front end. That is, trying to get the best claims that we can that really cover the aspect of the invention up front. And so, you know, we're very heavily involved in front-end loading of a lot of our costs, a lot of our attention on that. And so the other thing I'd like to say from Qualcomm's standpoint, patents cost a lot of money. When you have a lot of them, it starts to run into real money, right? And so you can't afford to keep around the ones that aren't any good. And so, you know, every year I am on an ongoing basis looking at which patents we have and
you mean the renewal fees you pay each year?
Not just renewal fees, but things that are in prosecution. So sometimes you'll file a patent on an idea that's well ahead of its time, and you want to give it some amount of time to either gain market success or not gain market success. And so you let it live for a little bit of time. It's kind of like it's almost like buying an option on the idea that you're trying to drive out into the marketplace. And if it turns out that it doesn't get any marketplace traction, you let it die and you abandon it in prosecution even before it issues. Because of those real financial considerations, as large companies we're constantly pruning, and our business model is in no way built on trying to have more patents than someone else. Once you have sort of a critical mass, it's really just do you have strategically the right complement of patents and the right technologies, and have your predictions about the roadmap of the future come true. So we're also a product company, right? Most of our revenue, two-thirds of our revenue, actually comes from the sale of chips, and so we get to see lots of approaches of patents that may or may not be high quality, whatever quality means. That is, we believe we have good defenses too, and so we try to deal with those just as quickly as we can. And in our experience, potentially it's just because we have, let's say, a different business than Google. Google maybe is more attractive to somebody who wants to assert low quality patents, but the kind of products that we make, we don't get nearly as much. We'll get 10, questionable assertions in a year, whereas other companies might get more.
So from that perspective, it's interesting to see how the PTAB, it comes differently. Apparently, patent quality makes companies differently as well. Suzanne, do you see a lot of low-quality patents in this sort of nuisance litigation, and how big a problem is it for the system?
Yeah, we do feel a lot of the troll litigations involving low-quality patents. We feel like the software space is awash in some pretty bad patents. I think the breakout sessions and our discussion here talking about functional claiming and ALICE in Section 101 and what's going on there are important responses to the quality problem for software patents. A lot of this is historical. There was a long debate in the 90s about should software be patentable, how do we patent it, and we have State Street Bank issuing in the late 90s, kind of really opening the floodgates at exactly the same time that the Internet is starting to take off. And so you see from the early 2000s this rash of patents of sell something on the Internet, US Girl on the Internet. All of those, which are now patents that can be asserted very widely against 200 retailers at one time or a whole lot of tech companies operating on the Internet and, therefore look like they might be able to generate a high payout. But on the other hand, there are sort of patents that don't really contain much of a technical contribution to society at all. They're just really doing on the Internet patents. And I think that's part of what was driving the increase in troll litigation. I want to say something about the rational ignorance point, because I've actually given this a lot of thought. And Mark Lemley did have this paper, which it was sort of the mid to early 90s, rational ignorance at the patent office, the idea that we don't spend a lot of society resources up front determining validity because the, quote unquote, important patents will get litigated and let's do it then. I think that might have been true at the time that the article was written, but the problem is it's no longer true. And that depends on what's an important patent, right? An important patent you would think would be one that would cover a technical contribution to society that was commercially important and therefore making money. That's not necessarily the source of some of those patents do get litigated. Those are important patents, and they get a closer look on litigation. But now that we've fallen into the realm of nuisance value litigation, every patent is as valuable and as important as the cost of litigation. And if the cost of litigation is a lot, then you got a problem. And in a lot of ways, it's really sort of the worst patents that are sometimes the most valuable in that sense. And that is why, and I've been really excited to see the Patent Office doing the Enhanced Patent Quality Initiative to really, I think, be turning away from this idea to be thinking more deeply about how to do a better job at the patent office up front. I don't think it would take a whole lot more resources to do a much better job up front, you know, and that needs to come not just from the patent office but from applicants. You know, needs to cost more to file so that the examiners can have more time, and there's such a huge disconnect between what it costs to get a patent and how much time and energy put into the upfront and what it takes to invalidate one in court. It seems to me now at this point become clear that we need to put more effort upfront.
Oh, so let me just concur with Suzanne and point out a couple of things. First, Colleen Chan, who was very responsible for some of these quality efforts when she was in the White House, and I have a blog post on Patent Leo today about saluting the Enhanced Patent Quality Initiative, and well, so a lot of what I say is in that blog post if you want to read more about it. But the piece that I think is, in addition to all the great stuff that Suzanne said, is really important to keep in mind with respect to the rational ignorance argument, is that what Suzanne said at the very end is absolutely right, that it doesn't take that much in the way of resources to make the scope of a patent clearer. So the Section 112 kind of rejections that one could get are not expensive rejections for an examiner to make. And that sort of thing, it seems to me, is exactly what some of the Enhanced Patent Quality Initiative stuff is focusing on. Now, the issue of searching prior art is potentially more expensive, and that gets into the question of whether examiners should get more time than all the rest of it, and that is actually something the PTO may, depending on what the Trump administration wants to do, may take a look at. But on the AI point, they are, so the PTO is, has contracted with an artificial intelligence company to do automated pre-examination search as a pilot, and thus far, sorry, Suzanne, it's working better than Google does.
Google has it free.
But it's, I need to say this. It's a Durham-based company. It's called AI Patents. Yeah, and I actually know the founder, so.
John, what's your view on the whole patent quality question?
Well, one of the things that one of the things that's happened over the last 30 years or so is that the under the leadership of the Federal Circuit is that many doctrines that were designed that used to exist in the circuit courts and in Supreme Court precedent that limited patents or that distinguished between so-called pioneer patents and mere improvement patents and interpreted them differently have been abolished. So pioneer patent, if you do like a Lexis search, a Westlaw search, it used to be used in just about every patent case. You know, the first thing the court had to figure out was, gee, how much of a contribution was this deal? And then they used that to determine how to interpret the patent. Indeed, there's a Supreme Court precedent that says that should be the first step in patent litigation. None of that, all of that is disregarded by the Federal Circuit. And that creates some of the quality problems. Because sometimes the quality problem is not that this person should never have gotten a patent. But in fact, they maybe did do something that was, you know, helped a certain technology and solved a certain problem. And, but now they're trying to assert it maybe years later in a different technological concept, area. And they are trying to interpret, you know, numerous words in the claims very broadly. And it used to be that there was numerous doctrines that are just more abundant now, that have been killed by the Federal Circuit. They used to stop that practice. And I think that one of the reasons why you hear two sides, there is the high-tech community that says, oh, there's all these bad quality patents, and then you hear from patent, people who are seeking patents and say, it's gotten really hard to get a patent, and, you know, we're trying to get patents nowadays, and it's hard. I think both of those can be true. And then sometimes the small inventors who are trying to just get a very smallish patent on a small tweak should get that small patent as long as it's going to be interpreted smallishly in the future. And there's other limits that would protect against those patents being asserted broadly. I think patent owners are often looking for just the option value and that they should be able to look for the option value. In other words, they should be able to file and get some sort of right, get protection of their rights in the sense that they will get a patent if they want to pursue it later. A lot of countries allow you to sort of file your patent application, but to stay prosecution for some years, and you won't be running up the fees while that's occurring. And that seems to me like a reasonable idea. And the final point I'll make is to just cite a law review article, is a law review article that I and a co-author did a few years ago called Ending the Patenting Monopoly. Not the patent monopoly, but the patenting monopoly. In other words, if you want to get a patent in this country, you have to go to one bureaucracy that is staffed with unionized workers. And there's a years-long or at least a year-long queue you have to wait in before you can get anybody to look at this. It's one-size-fits-all. It's a Soviet-style kind of command and control system. And it is not the way other countries work. For example, in Israel, they will say, you get a patent if you've gotten a patent from any one of 13 patent offices across the world. And that's not, academic medicine.
Reciprocity, in other words.
So that's work sharing among countries. But you could also imagine work sharing among entities. So you could have a good entity, the equivalent of Qualcomm, except actually a patent examining firm that has a really good reputation, so that Suzanne would sit here and say today, well, if that firm issued the patent, if they certified that you were technical, we won't challenge that patent because we know they have good standards. Now, everybody knows that if the PTO issued the patent, Suzanne, tell me this, if the PTO examiner has issued a patent, is that something that really gives you respect for it, that you won't challenge
well,
that?
Well, if it's in Denver, yes, of course.
So that I'd like to see. I'd like to see an office in Denver that doesn't have to be run by the PTO, that can examine patents.
Is Molly here yet? She gets to see. Right,
exactly.
What's your thought, Charlie?
I agree with John that one size fits all is not the way to go. I'm not sure that one needs to privatize the system in order to get that, though. And we already are seeing glimmers of a non-command and control bureaucratic system, even in the PTO, which you're right is unionized and that has challenges. So there is something called a fast track application process that is used by 50% of the applications there are filed by smaller micro inventors, as contrasted with about 20% of the general population. So that was specifically set up so as to provide a fast track for those who really needed a patent to attract venture capital. And I think that, and this is in the post as well that Colleen and I did, that if Congress authorized it, I think Congress would need to authorize it. I don't think PTO can do this on its own. Some sort of what some people used to call, well, you said gold-plated, but gold-plated in the front end, or bulletproof patent might be an option PTO should be able to offer versus not so gold-plated or not so bulletproof. And it seems to me that that is certainly plausible as a legal matter if Congress authorizes it.
So I want to get questions involved from the audience, but before that, let me let people know, if you wanted to sit on Twitter, it's hashtag Silicon Flat Irons all together to kind of have the Twitter conversation going on. The next point, and I'll try to keep this as short as we can, it's a big topic, software patents, Section 101, the intellectual ventures versus Symantec case is a really big, interesting deal. Let's just keep it on your thoughts on that case and what it stands for, and then we'll get the folks here involved. Roger, you
want to
kick this one off?
Yeah, so I'm going to start with a high-level thing about software patents, because I'm on the software breakout panel, and I'll go a little bit more into that. Where I think we are with software patents is coming back towards where we ought to be. With every major shock to the system, whether it was Markman or KSR or Festo, or there's a time when everyone who's a patent owner goes back and looks through their portfolio and tries to figure out, is half my portfolio now worthless? So all that uncertainty, I think, has been reduced, particularly this year, with a string of decisions that have all come out in 2016. And so I think we're basically on the right track there to trying to articulate, at least some framework for determining what's patentable or not. And, the USPTO, draft guidelines, or I should say guidelines that they published, they tend to reduce uncertainty as well. And from the business standpoint, That's kind of what I need to know. I need to know that things aren't going to be catastrophic, and then I need to know with some certainty what the rules are, and then I can make plans and strategies around that. What I cannot tolerate is someone changing the goalposts in the middle of the game or switching things around. And of course, I don't want to go back into arguments about whether software should or should not be patentable, because I think we're well past that in the development of the law here, and we're just on the fine-tuning stage. But I will at least throw out one more thing that, lots and lots of patents that we did not think could be implemented in software before are now implementable in software. And so my greatest fear is that we do something that eventually sort of undermines the value of patents that really actually are very valuable and really did, advance the arts, because now the way that design choice has played out, that designers are going more towards software than hardware.
Suzanne, how do you see this issue?
Not as different as you might think.
We like that. Great.
I would agree. There was consternation amongst the patent bar, obviously, when Alice came out, and there still is in a lot of places, and I appreciate it. I understand that. Overall, we see the developments in 101 as a positive thing for innovation in the software industry. And in the past year has brought a little more clarity around drawing that line between eligible software patents and ineligible. And that is a good thing, and I would expect as the case law develops that, that will continue. We'll continue to define that line and can bring more clarity and certainty. The problem that Alice addressed, and it was a really serious problem consistent with my earlier statement, was that there were a lot of these do it on a computer patents that really did not contribute anything to technological innovation, and that they were being very broadly interpreted, widely asserted, and there was no technology in them. And now deciding whether what we've seen in the case law developed that we like and that we would like to see further developed is this focus on, does this claim recite a technological solution? Is this an improvement rooted in computer technology? To get away from this sort of business method stuff, the abstract ideas just on a computer, to get away from, I think you mentioned that in intellectual ventures case, that claim was about a scan for a virus. It said nothing about how, right? You ought to, I can see software innovations that ought to be patentable. It can be really tough to scan for viruses and emails and then flag them, and figuring out how to do that in a better way can be a real invention and ought to be patentable in software. But on the other hand, saying just do it and not providing any level of specificity is not what the patent system is about, if you believe the patent system is about technological innovation. And so I see the Alice case law moving in that good direction to try to draw that line. It feels to me easier to apply, and it feels to our team who writes the patents, easier to figure out how to draft specifications and claims than trying to make sense of the difference between fluke and deer.
So quick question for Roger, because you think it's there. Business method patents, are they dead?
Don't know, don't have any.
And then if they are dead, it just goes back to Bilkey having been like a near miss, because that could have been decided in Bilkey if it was near cleaner. What's your thought on this, Dan?
Well, I think it's actually the patents that have come to the Supreme Court have been horrible patents across basically all grounds. If you look at the article I did about why business method patents, that actually looks at financial technology, real financial technology, not junk like Bilski, you realize the people in the peer-reviewed journals in finance began describing what they were doing as engineering in the 1980s, long before State Street. People people in the 1950s in the American Economic Review, there's an article that says, well, you know, there's a certain branch of economics that's beginning to look more like engineering. And the term financial engineering was coined long before the patent system came to be. That technology doesn't look like Bilski. It's not just do it on a computer or something else like that. It is serious, hardcore technology that involves lots of math, lots of engineering, and that stuff looks a lot like engineering in other fields. You don't have any of those patents. Suzanne Michel doesn't have, her company doesn't have any of those patents, and those patents are rare for a variety of complex reasons, including that some nations simply say there are no business method patents, and some of these things are more easy to keep as trade secrets. But I think that the holding of Bilski was right as a matter of law, that business methods are patentable. I think they have to be good business method patents. And we just haven't seen so many of those, or those haven't been litigated. We've seen some junk business method patents. And that's why people say, I think wrongly, business method patents are dead. There might be, you know, a trough of business method patents right now, but in the long run, and I'm an academic, I can play for the long run, I think that we will see that there are some business technologies that we'll be very thankful that we have.
So already sum up, business method patents, software, and you can add a word on biotech, which comes out of the Myriad case also in 101.
So I think the casualty of all this, I think at the end of the day, the 101 cases in the high-tech area created confusion and uncertainty, but it's being resolved. And at the end of the day, yes, most businesses that are out, and that's probably a good thing. There may be a few of John's ideas that would be patentable in the, you know, 50 years from now or what have you, and that's fine too. Where the casualty has, or the blood has been spilled, is in the biotech space, which is not, I know, a focus necessarily of the audience here, but there are, I think, real uncertainties with respect to the diagnostic space in particular, where we just have not gotten any resolution. So there is a case called Rapid Litigation Management that tried to do something with the biotech space on 101, but I don't think it can reasonably be distinguished from any other case where 101 knocked out the diagnostic patent.
To go deep on this, and I did an event here with our biotech association, and they almost admitted the following. I'll be curious for those of you who follow this. Had they conceded Myriad and fought more intelligently on the Mayo case, they would have protected lots of patenting in diagnostics, and they would have been better off than basically saying, we want to protect all possible patents in biotech, and ended up with what you said, and ended up helpfully. Is that a fair conclusion? What's your reaction to that?
Well, Myriad was not something that the biotechnology industry or organization ever wanted to get to the Supreme Court. This was something they begged the Myriad company, which is not a member of Bio, to settle and not take the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court really messed it up, essentially, which it did, more or less. Mayo, I think, was a surprise to them. I don't think they expected Breyer to do what they did, or what he did. And I don't think Breyer understood exactly what he was doing. So by the time we got to Alice, we got a little more understanding, I think, and certainly more understanding of how this could apply in the high-tech space. But I think that there is there's a nice concurrence by Judge Dyke in the Ariosa case that I think lays out a framework that the Supreme Court could adopt in the future were it so inclined, and that's where I would go.
So let's get the audience involved. People may remember the Silicon Flatirons rule that we have students ask the first question. So do we have a student here? Harry may be able to out you if you don't otherwise volunteer. And a recent grad will do, so. Stephanie, you're the obvious one to go. For people who don't know Stephanie, she's done lots of great work with Silicon Flatirons over the years. We're so appreciative. To reward you, I'll embarrass you and put you on the spot. Do you have a question you might be willing to ask?
Not right now.
All right. Fair enough. Any other recent students with questions they're willing to ask?
Yeah.
All right. Not so recent students. Dan McCormick, you have a question you want to ask?
Greater than 7 years ago,
the time
that's not really.
At this point, you're still a recent student to me, so.
um, I mean, I don't. I think it's more, my questions are with the panel, that I'm
going
to jump too far into it.
I've got plenty more questions for the panel. I'd love to get everyone involved. Other questions from anyone here? Yeah, Fred.
So I'd just like some feedback on this proposal. Tim Wilson at SAS has suggested that we have a registration system simply. John, you had talked about something like this along these lines. But his suggestion was that if you wanted to go on search, you would then, in essence, invite the people you were going to send letters to participate in an IPR so that we concentrate the examination on the ones that are actually going to be asserted, because we have 3 million patents and only 5,000 of them are in litigation. Why are we spending any time on the remainder?
So I'll repeat the question now, but get it right. Could you have some kind of registration system when you've got a patent done? And let me just develop your proposal, John.
Other people have said this, too.
Yeah, which is you could get this body, let's pretend it's not the PTO, it's some contracted-out body who's acting as a registrar, and they would say when someone comes to patent, okay, I know the other people in this space. I'm going to reach out to them, get their input, and try to figure it out.
Before they asserted and went after anybody, would have to say, I'm going after these 10 people. You 10 people, you come and fight me in an adversarial administrative proceeding.
Right. And this would be before the patent would issue, or would it be like some special?
No, after it issues, it's like just sits there waiting for in that pool of 3 million, you know, maybe never to see the light of day. But the 5,000, we'll spend all of our examination resources on that 5,000.
So Tim is a good friend because Seth is based about 10 miles from where I live. But he and I have had lots of discussions about this idea. I could see a remarkable amount of gamesmanship going on. If anyone and his brother could register and then begin to assert, then you'd have essentially an IPR system that was huge. I mean, it'd be much more than 5,000. There'd be, I don't know how many, but you can't assume, you've got to think of this question dynamically, you can't assume that the number of patents that would be registered and asserted would be at all similar, or even, you know, educated to be at least several orders of magnitude higher than we currently see. And could any sort of IPR system deal with that? I'm not sure.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be 3 million, right?
It'd be,
I don't know, what, 10 points. And in the countries that have a two-tiered patent system, you're examining patents and you're sort of unexamined patents, and they're called different things in different places, innovation patents in Australia. I forgot what they call them in China. It's become a real concern in China. There's, you know, so many millions of these things, and they're just sitting there. And if you're a company who's trying to understand your patent landscape before, you know, as you're designing your project and as you launch it, it's almost impossible now. I mean, it's pretty much... It's like all the more impossible if you have 10 million unexamined patents just sitting out there. And so for the most part, we'd like to see these petty patent systems done away with in other countries, and would not want to recreate them in the United States.
So, well, petty patent systems are different because they have fewer rights associated with them, too. So this is a different...
In some countries... Before you assert, you then have to put the patent into examination. And I like Tim's idea of let's bring in the highly motivated potential defendant, and I think that's a difference, which makes it really interesting. But I'm just a little nervous about the quantity.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to give people, to have a little bit more freedom and innovation in this space. And, you know, Artie went through some of the proposals recently of gold-plated patents in different tracks. And essentially, one of the problems, I think, is we're relying on a government bureaucracy to be innovative. And if any of you think that's a good idea, then maybe you haven't studied innovation very often. I think that if you want to have innovative ideas, you have to open it up. You look at what other countries are doing, as Suzanne just did, but look at, you know, having more actors who could actually rapidly evaluate how good the patent is and give us some sense of that. Maybe even artificial intelligence. You could register the patent and put it through a private system that was pretty good. Maybe actually say that if that patent is asserted, it will be under a loser pays rule so that the attorney's fees will always be shifted if you assert until you get it fully examined. There might be some tweaks to try to work out the gamesmanship in this. One of the problems is that
is we don't have a very innovative patent system because we have a monopolistic patent system.
So, but John, I mean, no matter what, Congress would have to authorize some entity to come up with the rules for experimentation, right? Like, the private, it couldn't tell IBM, you go and develop all the rules for experimentation for the U.S. patent system, because that would be an inappropriate delegation of authority to a private entity.
You certainly could, but you can imagine somewhere, but at some point this has to be authorized by legislation, and that's true. And therefore, you know, that's true. You can come up with legislation that tries to have, that tries to foster more innovation. And
yeah,
I think we're not even close to that.
Yeah, and I have no problem with that, but at the end of the day, there has to be some public sector actors at least overseeing the system.
So I think it's great, and you know, this in the Al Gore, I'm going to cite Al Gore here. I'm a relatively conservative guy. I'm going to cite Al Gore thought this reinventing government was this great idea, and towards the end of the Clinton administration. I actually think that it had one very basic and correct insight, which is that government is often good at regulating and steering an organization rather than being the organization that does all the work. This is based on, and I think that's the problem right now, is that government is the employer of all these examiners who are heavily bureaucratized and are not innovative, and many of the things that we would like to see are just simply very, very hard to get the government agency to do. If the government agency were instead to sort of master and sort of looking over, you know, what are these firms doing that are examining patents, or are they doing a good job?
Yeah.
That they would identify the ones that are doing the bad job and the ones that are doing the good job.
So I should note in a note of self-promotion, for those interested in this idea, I've just written a piece called Entrepreneurial Administration. I've not talked about this case study, but it's very relevant to it. There's a lot of literature around government working with private bodies, could be for-profit, could be non-profit, and it's a very promising area. Now we're going to fulfill that promise, and let me first acknowledge Anna Noscazi, and Kelly Chung here, too. We have an unbelievable team and a group of student volunteers. Thank you so much. Before I take the cue, let me first acknowledge you and round of applause for Anna. Everyone here knows.